future of their country, and even of local issues, are expressed and often even decided. Most importantly, of course, historians have long argued that this public sphere is the essential foundation for a democratic society and exists in all societies that really develop modern democracy. Here's the place where civic democracy can thrive even before the state has fully reformed itself in a democratic way. And it's said without such a vital civic sphere, a public sphere, democratic society and the possibility of democracy suffocates and dies. In Russia, in the late 1800s, and especially in the years after the reforms that we've talked about before of 1905-1906, it is clear that such a public sphere is truly flourishing, especially in the urban areas. One major sign of this is the really rapid development of the press in early 20th century Russia. Commercial newspapers with wide circulation began to appear, especially in the years after 1905, some of which had very influential journalists who helped give a voice to public life, to help shape public opinion in many ways, and echoed views that were being talked about in these civic spaces. Magazines began to appear for various particular interests and tastes and levels of education, including, as I mentioned, the hugely popular illustrated magazines written for, published for lower class audiences that covered the whole story of the world. Thick journals proliferated, serious, heavy, unillustrated, intellectual journals filled with complex ideas. And the book publishing market expanded very rapidly in these years, including books for popular readers, for lower class readers. Second sign, major sign of this flourishing public sphere was the proliferation of voluntary associations, civic organizations designed to promote the public interest. The sort of organizations that you may know that Alexis de Tocqueville, a famous French aristocrat and observer of world politics in the mid-19th century, described in his famous book, Democracy in America, as the truest foundation of democratic life emerging in the United States, these voluntary associations, which seemed so proliferating then. In Russia, one sees something similar, though much later, obviously, late 19th, early 20th century. Charities, for example, proliferated, organized by noblemen, by rich merchants, by members of the royal family, all engaged in public activities. Service organizations began to proliferate, organizations like the Moscow Literacy Society, or various societies to promote useful public amusements, as they were called. Many of them, not surprisingly, concerned with the public amusements already found in the villages, but also in the cities. Societies to disseminate useful knowledge, temperance societies, Bible societies, and hundreds of similar organizations existing in every city in Russia by the early 1900s. Business and professional societies also began to form, and many of them gathered in congresses and exhibitions, published their own journals and newspapers. Merchants organized professional organizations. So did factory owners, publishers, journalists. Doctors gathered together in their own organization. Legal specialists, jurists, teachers, engineers, and others. And after 1905, all of these were joined by political parties, which were now finally legal, covering the whole spectrum from moderate socialists to monarchists. Also, organizations, civic organizations, began to proliferate among the urban lower classes. Before 1905, these existed especially in the form of a variety of types of mutual aid societies, burial societies, where workers would share money to help cover the funeral of one of their members, mutual assistance funds in case one became unemployed or needy in other ways due to illness or injury at work, cultural societies of all sorts. And after 1905, these were joined by trade unions, which were legalized in 1906, and an enormous proliferation of cultural clubs where workers got together to talk, to drink tea, to read literature, to see performances, to sing, various ways they came together as a type of free public. There were also various non-governmental forms of education beginning to proliferate in these years. Private schools, private institutes, private charity schools for lower class Russians, and all over the country began to appear what were called people's universities, places where lower class Russians, mainly workers, artisans and others, could go and hear lectures from often prominent scholars of their day, join reading circles, participate in amateur theatrical productions, and the like. Also relevant in terms of spaces where a diverse public could gather and feel itself to be emerging as a public were various forms of public entertainment that began to be developed by not the state but by private individuals in Russia's cities in the early part, especially of the 20th century, and even more after 1905. What were called pleasure gardens began to appear in the summer in most big cities, where there would be fairs and rides and booths and all sorts of exciting activities that one could wander about and, if one had a little bit of change, afford to truly enjoy. Music halls began to appear, cabarets, mainly for the middle classes, where performances were often modeled after music halls and cabarets to be found in Western Europe. Circuses existed in every major city, and it wasn't just the normal circus performance, but also other public activities, including the most popular wrestling matches that were held on the floor of the circus. And cinemas began to proliferate in this emerging public space, especially in cities like St. Petersburg and Moscow. They were often showing Western films. Silence, travelogues were very popular, newsreels, but increasingly after 1912, Russian films. Though the Westernness of these places was always important, they tended to have names, for example, to mention two of the most popular theaters in St. Petersburg, like Parisiana, which actually still exists in Petersburg, or the Crystal Palace, a sense of being part of the world through cinema. Of course, none of this existed without the typical resistance of the state. Police, especially the secret political police, watched every civic organization, and if it became political, shut it down. The press was always subject to censorship. Newspapers were subject to censorship before publication. Certain political things couldn't be said. And every thicker work, a book or a fatter journal, would be censored afterwards. If it said something illegal, it would be brought before a court and fined and perhaps shut down. And, of course, none of the civic life had much influence on the policies of the state. It was vital and alive and engaging, but the state was going along making policies without much influence by public opinion. Still, with all these caveats still present, we can see in many ways a modern society, a modern urban society is emerging in Russia. Growing industry, growing industrial classes, growing cities, growing civic sphere, and an increasingly cosmopolitan culture. However, this modernity, this urban modernity, this thriving public sphere also had a very dark face, especially in urban areas. The Russian city was a place of excitement and opportunity and possibility. It was also a place filled with danger and problems. And one could see this most clearly by picking up the daily newspapers of major Russian cities in these early years before World War I. For example, if you were sitting in St. Petersburg and picked up one of the major dailies in 1910, you might read articles filled with encouraging reports that make you think Russia was heading in a positive direction if you were a liberal-minded, educated Russian, as many were. Stories, for example, about the spread of scientific knowledge and technical know-how about new inventions would appear and how these were being adapted in Russia. Stories of entrepreneurial success, how individuals build businesses. Stories about upward social mobility. And, very importantly for many urban readers, want ads that would give you a chance to read about jobs that you could have that would improve your lot. There was a great deal of reporting about all these various institutions of civic life that I've been describing. There were even articles about how wonderful it is to live in a city, the civilizing effects of living in streets that weren't covered with mud, around buildings that had beautiful facades, and streets that were laid out in an orderly way. But you also, in these newspapers, read much more troubling stories about city life, stories likely to make you think about degeneration rather than progress. Danger, you would learn, was ubiquitous in a Russian city. Streetcars, for example, one of the great symbols of modern life, would suddenly, you would often read in the paper, leap off their tracks and kill somebody or maim somebody. For one example, in 1910 in St. Petersburg, a streetcar slipped off its tracks and ran over a peasant who was in the city working as a cook, trying to advance himself, severing both of his legs. In response, an infuriated crowd, tired of hearing these sorts of stories, ended up jumping on the streetcar, pulling off the driver, and severely beating him. Elevators, you would read in the press, suddenly crashed to the ground. Buildings in the midst of construction suddenly collapsed. Fires broke out inexplicably. You'd be reading the paper and you'd hear about mad dogs, for no particular reason, roaming about the cities and biting innocent passersby. You'd read about debauched men preying on women and children. You'd read about women, poor and desperate, lured into prostitution to survive. Prostitution, which was legalized to regulate it, in particular to protect health and the spread of, in particular, syphilis. Mysterious bodies, you'd read in the paper, are suddenly discovered floating in the river or in the canal or in the edge of the city. You'd read about disease in the city, syphilis and cholera and typhus, much worse than in any rural area. And at night, you would read in the papers, thieves were at work everywhere, breaking into apartments, mugging people on the streets. Now, these are facts. These things truly happened. But very important for the readers of these stories, these were indeed stories written about, exaggerated, overemphasized, thought about, part of the image of what you felt urban life was about. Very troubling, you also would learn in reading from the press is in the city, you don't know who to trust. For example, a well-dressed gentleman and lady, it was said in an article, Petersburg, 1910 again, might walk into a store, suggest that they would like to buy a very nice fur coat. They were well-dressed. You figured they had the money if you were a sales clerk. When the sales clerk turns his or her back, they would run off with the goods. Such stories were very common. Just because people looked well-dressed didn't mean they were moral or even wealthy. The city is full of disguises. Or another story from 1910. A merchant is walking down the streets of St. Petersburg, the street being, of course, at the center of civic life and also a symbol of the dangers of the city, walking down the street, and two well-dressed women, it's always said that they're well-dressed in these stories, come up to him. One of the women greet him very warmly, "Oh, it's so good to see you," and begins kissing him on the lips. Meanwhile, the other woman walks behind him and begins to find his wallet and pull it out. He tries to scream, but the other woman only kisses him more intensely. They get away with his money. Other events are much more dangerous than this. It's often said how, again, a well-dressed man walks up to a passerby, asks him for the time, and while he's looking at his watch, pulls out a knife and stabs him. Maybe robs him, maybe just runs away. Appearances in the city are deceptive. This is something you'd learn in reading the papers. Another major urban problem was what was called widely in the press hooliganism, seen as characteristic of urban life. These included a whole variety of public street crimes, or just outrageous behaviors, as you'll see, in which mainly young men, sort of working class street toughs on the whole, would threaten respectable pedestrians, harass them, sometimes physically assault them. And newspapers invariably describe these events as not just crime, but as assault on civilized respectability, something that was seen as fragile and at risk. Many hooligan acts were really meant, as this comment and as this interpretation suggests, to outrage, to annoy the new urban middle class, the new urban bourgeoisie. A young working class tough or a group of them might be walking down the street, see somebody well-dressed, and simply walk up and bump against them just to be annoying, especially if it was a woman. They enjoy doing it even more. Groups of hooligans, sometimes drunk, would block whole sidewalks, even in the center of the city, swearing loudly at people, singing bawdy songs, just making a nuisance of themselves. Gangs of these youths would sometimes walk up behind a well-dressed woman and pull the ribbons out of her hair. Or perhaps they would show a little flip book with pornographic images in it, just to annoy. Or in one case, or rather one might say in a strange way, creative group of hooligans climbed onto a streetcar with a wasp nest, threw it on the floor, and as the wasp spread and began stinging people, ran out and escaped, laughing all the way. This hooliganism was sometimes not so funny. It could be very violent and dangerous as well. Stabbings, muggings were often described as hooliganisms. Especially, sometimes these were robberies, but it was more likely to be called hooliganism when these stabbings seemed to have no purpose, no rhyme or reason. Somebody was said to be stabbed and their wallet was still in their pocket. This senselessness was seen to be characteristic of hooliganism. There were also darker notes to be heard in the press. Death was seen as a pervasive part of urban life. The daily press is filled with accounts of accidental death by tram, by automobile, by bad food, by falling elevators. The press was filled with accounts of very high infant mortality rates in the city, and with accounts, as I've said, of various diseases such as cholera, which were said often to be characteristic of modern urban congestion and poor sanitation. And especially the press was filled with stories of murder and suicide. Murders, in fact, were reported with frightening or maybe numbing regularity in the press of the big cities of Russia. Popular daily papers offered readers a sort of grisly procession of knifings and beatings and stranglings involving all classes of people and all age groups, both men and women. Various causes were cited in the press. Many said these were connected with theft, with material greed, some elaborated. In other words, with part of the rising materialism of modern urban Russian life. Murder was also said to result from uncontrolled emotions, anger and jealousy and revenge, or even simply nervous stress, which again, some commentators noted, were part of living in a modern city. At the same time, many readers were told, and again, even more emblematic of the characteristics of what many described as the nature of Russia's modernity, many murders had no purpose whatsoever. These hooligan attacks where someone was killed with no reason at all. Often, a more essential but vaguer cause was given, but all of the same sort of argument, namely the nature of the modern city, the existential nature of urban, industrial, modern life in Russia. For example, in the words of one Petersburg journalist writing in the same year of 1910 in St. Petersburg, a man who liked to call himself the wanderer, for he wandered about and observed life. He said, "I am a cultured person," something many of his readers would have agreed with, "but here in the city, side by side with me lives a savage, and I might become his victim." Now, while murder seemed to characterize the dangers of the new urban society, suicide seemed to reveal its darkest inner soul. Papers often reported tragic suicides, especially by young people in the city, and dwelled frequently on suicide as a characteristic sign of the malady of the modern age, the malady of urban life, the problem with where Russia seemed to be heading. The majority of suicides, in fact, occurred at home, but what really attracted the attention of the press were these many suicides that took place in public. In a way, the dark side of this public sphere, of the civic life. Suicides in restaurants, suicides in city parks, suicides where people jumped off the bridges of St. Petersburg into the canals and rivers, suicides right out of high apartment windows onto the street before. Public suicides, usually in broad daylight. Here was truly a dark side of this emerging civic life. Now, although the reasons for suicides were typically described in the newspaper reports that masses of urban Russians were reading as unclear, journalists who commented on these stories tended to always point in the same place: the nature of modern urban life, of Russia's transformation into an urban, modern society. For example, one writer, a woman named Olga Gridina, who worked for a very popular St. Petersburg newspaper called Gazeta Kopeyka, which means the Kopeck Gazette, the penny newspaper, in other words, said that the main cause of this proliferation of suicides in Russia was simply the life of the modern city. At one point, she's writing about a very well-known story in which three young female students who had come from the provinces to advance themselves in St. Petersburg to study in its university committed suicide together in their apartment, dressed in white dresses, with Chopin's Funeral March on the piano, all very dramatic and often discussed. She said, why did these people, Why did these women with all this possibility in the world depart from life? And her answer is their youthful spirits thirsted for something elevated, ideal and great, but reality was bland and empty. And readers understood reality meant the reality of life in the modern urban capital like Petersburg. Or in another case, about another suicide, the same journalist and commentator, Olga Grydna, wrote, "If one could count the numbers who sorrow and suffer in cities, humanity would shudder." In other words, for urban dwellers, city life was indeed full of excitement and possibility and opportunity, but it was also a place filled with danger and fear, anxiety, and a sense of doubt about where Russia was heading. One, of course, could see this in pondering the political news as well that appeared in newspapers. The promise of civil rights, the work of the Duma, the power of the new legislature, but also in the limited power of the Duma and the police supervision of all of this civic life could also lead one to this uncertain meaning of modern life. And of course, we see the same in everyday street life, everyday city life that people were reading about so often. I want to conclude by looking still more deeply into this new urban life, by looking at it from the perspective of the newest type of city dweller. The one who would become indeed so important, already was important in 1905, and so important in the history of 1917, namely the industrial worker. There's a lot of stories one could tell about urban workers in Russia in the early 20th century, stories workers told about themselves, or people writing about workers. One, of course, is the obvious story of workers' hardships in this new modern industrial city, the difficulties of migration from the village, terrible living and working conditions, deep poverty. Another is the story of the possibilities, the pleasures of being in the city and no longer back in the village. Indeed, many workers were quite pleased to be in the city, however poor their lives seemed to be. They were so much better than life in the village. And they found something exciting about city life, the swearing and the arguing and the hawking of goods in the public marketplaces, the noise of the streets, the glow of the lamplights at night, the sounds of the factory whistles, the rhythms of the drive belts, the heroism for many of strikes and demonstrations, all seemed to suggest that some new world was emerging for many workers, as we know from their own writings, since workers were indeed much more literate than peasants. Indeed, related to that is the story one could also tell that was often told of workers awakening, their growing literacy. Most urban workers could read and write in the years after 1905. Or one could tell the stories often told of their growing personal pride that came from learning a very difficult industrial skill and learning to survive in the city. The story of their rising expectations, of their exposure to new ideas from the reading that they did, from the conversations they had with others. And, of course, the evidence of all these changes in the rising labor movement and growing membership in left-wing socialist parties. The story of their awakening, as socialists tended to call it. Now, to better understand all these stories, and all of these are parts of a whole, these large historical trends, let me suggest we listen to workers' own words in trying to describe how they felt about the world around them, what they desired. One important body of words that tell us something about workers' own perspective, something we lack for peasants, are collective demands, especially those that were presented during strikes or periods leading up to a strike. Many of the demands, when workers got together and found somebody to write up a list of demands that they present to the manager or the owner of their factory or shop, tended to be the usual sort of economic or political demands that one would have heard in 1905. We're now talking about the years after 1905 especially. Higher wages, they would call for. Shorter hours. Cleaner bathrooms. Less dangerous machinery. And they would usually throw in the political demand for civil rights. For the lack of police supervision of unions and the like. Many of these collective demands by workers were focused on what might be called moral issues. We've seen this in 1905, for example. A very common demand was for polite address, that workers should not be treated like children or animals and called ты, the informal you in Russian, but should be spoken to with respect. And in fact, workers often described ordinary economic demands, demands for greater sanitation in the bathroom, for safer machinery, for higher wages, for hot water provided for tea. They described these as demands that had to do with something more fundamental than improved conditions, but was about their right, as workers like to say, to live as human beings. Indeed, this phrase, the right to live like a human being, would be heard more and more in these demands. A deeper source of how these important growing class of workers felt about their world could be found in their diaries, in personal letters that they wrote, in essays that sometimes appeared in the trade union press or the party political press, again, coming from the most concerned and active and articulate among them. And what one notices even in private diaries and letters is also the centrality of these moral issues, these dignity issues. Consider some of the phrases one often finds in these writings. Workers have the right to live as human beings, as we saw in the collective demands as well. We are not machines. We are human beings. We are not slaves. We are not cattle. We are not camels. These sort of phrases kept being heard. And sometimes workers talked because they had listened to socialists and picked up this vocabulary, talked about the exploitation of the working class. But far more often, especially in their private remarks, workers would talk about despotism and cruelty and rudeness and insult and injury. And finally, and I need not explain the importance of this to you, we've seen it so often, though mainly out of the mouths of intellectuals up until this period, workers often justified their protests as a defense of leechness, of the human person, of the self, this Russian word that suggests both the nature of human beings as human and also the natural rights that result from this. In fact, some of the most interesting and in some ways remarkable expressions of workers' aspirations come in their own poetry. Almost all workers who became literate wrote some poetry, and many wrote a great deal of poetry. They're reading, they're thinking, they're trying to express themselves. It's not very good literature. I don't recommend it to you as high literature, but it tells us something very deep about their feelings about the world around them, and thus about the nature of that world we're trying to understand. Probably the most major theme one finds in workers' poetry in these years before 1914 is the suffering individual, the suffering self. Workers wrote constantly, for example, about the anguish of a mother, a working-class mother, watching her children starve. They wrote about their own childhoods ruined and lost by the hardships of lower-class life, whether back in the village or growing up in the city. They wrote about the sexual abuse of working women by foremen and employers, where women, as it was said, their feelings of human dignity are being trampled in the dirt. And, of course, they wrote about what they endured at work, low wages and dirt and violence from foremen, maimings by machines. The solution for many of these workers in this group would play such a key role in the events to come was fairly clear. A society and a political system that did one thing, respected the natural human dignity in all people. As we'll see when we get into the post-revolutionary period, this is a question they continue to ask about the regime that they eventually got. In other words, again, just as in talking about the intelligentsia, we come back to this critical idea of human dignity. And on the one hand, we can see that urban life, modern urban civilization allowed this human nature, this leechness, this self to thrive. It was a city filled with opportunities at every turn. On the other hand, it was a place filled with humiliations and indignities as well. Or on the one hand, to use a worker's own words from a poem, one can find in the city the cradle of the happy future life. And you've seen so much signs of that. On the other hand, in the words of another worker, the city is nothing but a cruel abyss that swallows up life and light. As in so much else we've seen, it's the contradictory possibilities of Russian life that is the one most consistent thing we can see in Russia on the eve of war and revolution. We'll see the same even more clearly as we look at culture, cultural life in late imperial Russia, the subject of the next lecture. We'll be right back.
Lecture 23, Fin de Siècle Culture, Decadence and Iconoclasm.
It's become more and more common to speak of the last years of old Russia, the years before World War I, as a Russian fin de siècle, using this French word for the end of the age. And indeed, deliberately using the French, the European term, to suggest that there's something in common with what's going on throughout Europe in these years. And yet, as you'll see, there's something, many would argue, distinct about the Russian fin de siècle, distinct in its intensity, and of course, distinct in the end that would result. And of course, we know what that end was, the result of these final years of the old order, that the old society and the old state, and in many ways the old culture, would come crashing down in the midst of war and revolution, making the other revolutions that took place in Europe as a result or during and after World War I, revolutions such as in Germany, seem really quite modest and tame by comparison. It's also worth saying that for many Russians, these years of the fin de siècle, cut before the war and the revolution, felt like a turning point. Even they didn't know exactly what was going to happen. Or worse, to many Russians at the time, it felt like a time of terrible crisis, of terrible decline, of approaching catastrophe. Some of the most salient signs of this, cultural signs of this crisis, and especially of this mood of crisis, are the subject of this lecture. Though, as I think you'll see, rather typically, these signs of crisis, of fin de siècle, can also be seen as other signs of Russia's intense cultural vitality, of creative possibility, of imagination about a new world. And indeed, we're seen in just this contradictory way by Russians. Now, in fact, this uncertainty about how to interpret these last years of the old regime are very important. Scholars have argued for a long time and still argue about where Russia was heading between, say, 1905, the wake of that first revolution and the reforms that followed it, and 1914, when the war came. We know, of course, where it ended up, but outcomes are not always the best evidence of all the complex dynamics, the complex possibilities that exist in a society at any given time. And in particular, therefore, historians often argue about what might have happened in Russia when looking at all of its complex dynamics. What might have happened had Russia not gone through the experience of World War I, the devastating experience of World War I? Optimists in this argument tend to argue that collapse and revolution were by no means inevitable. They emphasize all the major reforms of these years that we have seen, civil rights, the Duma, limited but still in many ways a major progressive change in Russian life. They talk about the legalization of trade unions, the proliferation of civic organizations and their legality, the freer and vital press, the intensely developing economic life, rise of industry, rise of cities, and they blame the war for overstraining what was still a weak but improving system. By contrast, people who are often called by historians the pessimists tend to see, in looking at this society, increasing political and social tensions even before the war. They note, of course, and we've talked about them as well, the inadequacies of reform, the very limited power of the Duma, its inability in particular to appoint or even control the actions of the ministers, of the government itself, or even the bureaucracy. They note the continued presence of a police state, of police supervision amidst this increasingly vital public sphere. They note, of course, and we have seen it, enormous social discontent. Peasants' desire for lands, workers' discontent with industrialization, and desire for often radical change and all the problems of urban life. Thus, they conclude that some sort of crisis was going to happen, whether or not the war took place. The war may have affected its intensity, its timing, but a crisis was coming. Now, as you may already have noticed in the way I've described all of these various trends, I hesitate to embrace either one of these interpretations, either the pessimist or the optimist interpretation. For me, the most salient characteristic of these final years of old Russia is not progress, not crisis, but the existence, indeed the coexistence and interconnectedness of both. In other words, the contradictoriness of the times, of these times, the multiple possibilities. We've seen this in rural life. We've seen this in urban life in these years, in society, in other words. And we see it very clearly when looking at culture in these years. First, I want to speak about, as an indication of these contradictory times as visible in culture, about what was often called cultural decadence of the early 20th century, seen as the main dominating direction of art and literature in these years. Decadence, of course, is a term that suggests challenges to morality. This includes, of course, deliberate acts by individuals and groups to challenge conventional moral standards, daring, outrageous acts of creativity by artists and writers and performers, deliberately countering established moralities. But decadence is also a term that's often used to suggest a perception of some generalized decline, moral, political, historical, a sense, in fact, of time itself as about decline and collapse, not about progress, about where the world is moving, especially the Russian world. And in fact, when many Russians looked about them, it was clear that traditions of order and morality seemed to be everywhere under challenge. Indeed, decadence seemed to be pervasive. One can see this even before we turn to the arts in looking at what many described as the decadence of everyday life. We've already seen some of this, the problem of hooliganism, the seemingly irrational challenge to moral norms. We've seen it in the problem of suicide that many described as part of a sense of deep cultural decline and crisis. In fact, many contemporaries were particularly dismayed as what they saw as decadence in the life of the most important new emerging class for, in a hope for a democratic, Western-style society, namely in the life of the middle classes, a growing group. People note the proliferation, for example, in middle-class culture of nightclubs and cabarets, especially in the years after 1905, where if you went into one of these cabarets, and they were often described in the press, and people heard about them and visited them, what you would see is a great deal, for example, of bawdy dancing, meant to be deliberately suggestive, filled with sexual innuendo, or you would hear comedians making sexual jokes. Some shows in cabarets or nightclubs often featured in these years female impersonators. And for good measure, these men dressed as women would be pretending to be some of the famous popular women singers of the day. A sense of moral corruption was viewed as widespread by those who looked at these acts. Or, for example, the proliferation of what were called by many low-brow cultural entertainments that attracted the middle and even some parts of the lower classes. Wrestling matches, for example, were extremely popular and hardly considered to be a sign of developed culture. In fact, in 1909, the papers were far more filled with news of a great wrestling match where a man appeared on the scene calling himself Black Mask with his face totally covered. No one knew who he was, but he was very mighty and can defeat wrestlers. Far more discussion of Black Mask and his exploits in the circus where the wrestling matches took place than of world news or of high culture or of talks about improving a civilization. Music halls proliferated, which attracted a lower class audience as well as the middle class. And again, in all of the skits in the music hall, sex was very often the most popular topic. Boulevard, what was called boulevard literature, proliferated. Cheap, inexpensive stories that were serialized in the major newspapers, then came out in cheap pamphlets, full of overwrought romance and tragedy, and of course, sex. And indeed, films, similarly, were often featured stories of great melodramatic romance and complex romantic entanglements. Contemporaries looking at all of this cultural space, this popular cultural space, found this to be, as one might expect, a contradictory type of decadence. Many were completely outraged or feared the disintegration of order and morality that all of this connoted. They felt a deep foreboding about where their country was going. How could you build a normal, civilized society with all of this moral decay? And many others felt quite excited and liberated by all of this even decadent culture. They were glad to see the old restraints dropping away, the restraints of village culture, of even what was called bourgeois cultural convention. They felt a sense of a great liberation, and they reveled in the possibilities of exploring new directions, of individuality, of being eccentric, of experimentation, of innovation. We see this same contradictory decadence reflected and encouraged in a great deal of modern art and literature of these years, a period known by historians as the Silver Age of Russian culture. For example, in a lot of art and literature, one sees a great deal of what might be called amoral aestheticism, an escapist love of beauty for its own sake with no concern for prevailing notions of what was decent and moral. Often this amoral aestheticism, this a love of beauty and of love, was often very positive and one might say appealing, evocation of physical beauty, of passion, of romantic love. One of the most popular poets of the time, especially among the educated, part of this trend, was a poet named Anna Akhmatova, along with other poets who were known as acmeists for their desire to have poetry reach the acme, the height of purity and artisticness. Most of their poems emphasized personal feeling. A fairly characteristic poem of 1911, for example, by Anna Akhmatova, began with the following fairly typical verse. "I wrung my hands under my dark veil. Why are you pale? What makes you reckless? Because I've made my loved one drunk with an astringent sadness." And this emphasis, however perhaps comical it may seem now, this emphasis on love and sadness and reckless daring was very characteristic of a lot of writings and literature and poetry of the time. There's also a darker side to this literature of amoral aestheticism, a fascination with a hedonism, with the joys of physical pleasure, with sexuality, with libertinism, with homosexuality, all very common themes in the literature of the day. Related to this in the art and literature of the time, especially the literature I'm emphasizing at first, one sees what is, might be described as pervasive sensualism, a fascination with the physical, with physical beauty and sexuality. And one very important and influential example of this, though they had to flee Russia, interestingly enough and tellingly, was the very famous Ballet Russe. This was founded in St. Petersburg, in the capital. It involves some of Russia's most important painters and composers and choreographers and dancers. But it had to move to France in 1909, where in fact it was very popular because the French enjoyed seeing the exotic wildness of Russian culture. But it was a Russian phenomenon in all ways. And their ballets, in particular, were filled with sensuality, so characteristic of the culture of the day. And we see this very clearly, for example, in the choreography and the dancing of the very famous dancer and choreographer of the time with the Ballet Russe, Vaslav Nijinsky, whose choreography and dancing was highly sensual, filled with sort of sexual charge, quite obvious when you see these dances. But indeed, the same sensuality is visible in the costumes, which were often quite daring, in set designs, and of course, in the stories. Now, another related theme, decadent theme in the culture, of the literature, especially at the time, was a fascination with the morbid. Many writers dwelled extensively on what would really be seen as the dark side of human life. Works were filled with images of death, especially suicide. And of course, as you can see, these are echoes indeed of what was going on in the society around them. Stories about murder, stories about slow death from disease were very common. Images of evil were also pervasive in a lot of the popular writing of the time. Stories about demons, stories about Satan himself began to appear, and indeed a whole series of paintings were devoted to the devil at one point. And also dark psychological moods were sort of pervasive in this literature. Characters were having delusions. They were going mad. They were suffering from deep melancholy. They were falling into despair. Now, another somewhat different but no less contradictory sign of the cultural world of fin de siècle Russia, the years between especially 1905 and 1914, was a movement of artists who called themselves futurists. Now, the name itself gives you an indication of a greater sense of possibility and a hope. And their goal was to subvert the present, to challenge the present in the name of the future. And they did everything they could, sort of in a way, an artistic version of the hooligans, everything they could to provoke and outrage, to challenge tradition. In fact, the most famous statement of this futurist challenge was a 1912 manifesto by the Moscow futurists, the title alone being revealing. It was described as a slap in the face of public taste. And it declared that everything about Russia's old culture was boring and old-fashioned and crass and cheap. Listen to some of its opening words. "We alone," the manifesto declares, "are the face of our time. Throw Pushkin, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, etc., overboard from the ship of modernity. From the heights of skyscrapers, we gaze at their insignificance." 2 years later came out an even more hooliganistic manifesto with the rather blunt title, "Go to Hell." And it repeated the same iconoclastic sentiments, as one words from the "Go to Hell" manifesto declared, "Today we spit out the past that has stuck to our teeth." The goal of these futurists, in their own words, was to shock the Philistines, the bourgeoisie, those with conventional values, and they did it absolutely every way they could. Starting, for example, with the way they dressed when they appeared in public, whether in theaters or cafes or cabarets or street performances, often designed to advertise readings in clubs. For example, one of the leading futurists, the poet Vladimir Mayakovsky, tended to read poetry and often appear in public dressed in brightly colored, sometimes polka-dotted shirts, not the way normal bourgeois Russians were dressed, or even peasants, very bizarre, sometimes hand-painted ties, and for good measure, in his buttonhole, he put a spoon, or maybe a radish. Another poet, friend of Mayakovsky's, another futurist named David Berliuk, often appeared in public with rather absurd pictures painted on his cheeks and his forehead, sometimes even nature scenes with a little bird, and also, just to add to the absurdity, a top hat, and maybe a vest made of two different vests sewn together to be contrary colors. And when they read poetry, it was almost always extremely loud. It was meant to shock. Mayakovsky, for example, even in the smallest club, in a tiny room, would often use a megaphone. And he had a very loud, booming baritone voice. These futurist performances featured a very lively interaction with the audience. This was part of this public life in these years. And part of this interaction with the audience, who tended to be middle class, involved insulting them. For example, in 1913, a reading performance was held that had the name "The First Evening of Speech Creators," and Mayakovsky began his little show by trying to offend everybody he possibly could. He saw some military officers sitting in the front row. He addressed them as "dear folds of fat in the stalls." He then sees a young man, and he points to him, and he says, "You men, you all have cabbage stuck in your mouths," questioning how respectable they really were. He points to a young woman. He says, "You women, you look like oysters in shells of objects." And, of course, the futurists' goal above all was to shock the Philistines, to wake up the bourgeoisie, to make people look beyond convention, above all in their art. In 1913, for example, two futurist poets, a man named Alexei Kruchonych and Velimir Khlebnikov, made this goal explicit in a manifesto. It said, "We think language must be, first of all, language, not about social reality," which was typical of art, of literature in the 19th century, remember Belinsky, "but nor should it be about feelings or soulfulness, the way Akhmatova and Acmeists wrote. And," this manifesto said, "if language has to remind us of something, let it remind us of a saw or a poisoned arrow of a savage." And in fact, the most important expressions of this shocking literature were futurist experiments with what were called trans-rational language. Language, it was in Russian, zaumny yazyk, or simply zaum, language that went beyond the mind, is literally what this means. And you have to hear it to really understand what this does. Indeed, the best known example of this is a 1913 poem by Kruchonych. Listen. Дербул стил, убещур скум, вы собу РЛ. Yes. Now, you don't have to know Russian to know what that means, because it means nothing in Russian or any other language. But from the futurist point of view, it meant a lot of things, however weird it seems, from a number of points of view. Partly, of course, it's the typical futurist iconoclastic game, a way of shocking. It was, in other words, the poisoned arrow of the savage. Partly, it was a deliberate invocation of savage-sounding sounds. In Russian, in particular, these were the harshest sounds you could possibly pick, the sort of combinations of letters that were said, that poets were advised to avoid. Terrible sounds. They embrace these rough, savage sounds. It's also, from their point of view, an echo of modern life, of the chaos, of the noise, of the confusion of modern life. Indeed, it's an embrace of all the wild, crazy savagery of modernity, of the meaningless of modernity, even. And of course, it's an attempt to express something deeper, something that conventional, ordinary words could not, a reality that could somehow only be conveyed through the emotion, especially primitive emotions. In other words, this was a savagery with meaning, a language not representational, describing tables or objects or trees or love, but something evocative and direct and primal, something emotional. Now, these futurists carried this savage attack on Philistine civilization, as they saw it, into the visual arts as well. And their fundamental goal was the same. Again, as stated in another manifesto, they loved manifestos, this one called The Word as Such, but it talked about painting as well. It said, "We are just as dissatisfied with pictures painted in jelly and milk as with verses built on sa-sa-sa, c-c-c-t-t-t." In other words, in painting, too, what they wanted was the savagery and power of Dir Bulschil, this poisoned arrow of the savage. One sees this, for example, in the paintings of one of the leading futurist painters of the time, Mikhail Larionov. Like a lot of artists and writers of the time, he was fascinated with the East, with images of the East, which he felt to be somehow part of Russia's nature, its Asianness, its savagery, and hence something good. No less important, when he used color, he always used color in a daring, unconventional way. There's something philosophical in his use of color. The point is to use color not realistically to reflect the world we think we know, what our eyes tell us. What could be more bourgeois or Philistine than that, to paint in the real colors of the seemingly real world, but colors that revealed an intuitive and emotional reality. And of course, the emotions to be conveyed in art, such as Larionov's, were not the tame platitudes of the bourgeoisie, as they saw it, not sa-sa-sa, but strong, vital emotions like Dir Bulschil, wild and primitive, and they would say truer. Another very famous example of this artistic futurism is the work of Kazimir Malevich. Sometimes, for example, we see in his work an explicit iconoclastic challenge to high culture. For example, pictures quite famous by him that juxtapose a cow and a violin, the symbol of high culture and the symbol of unculture. Or even more clearly, paintings by him, for example, that take a picture of Da Vinci's famous Mona Lisa, another symbol of established European culture, and they cross it out and surround it with abstract modernist objects. But his most famous work of these years was a series of abstract paintings he did that were displayed most famously at a Petrograd exhibition in 1915, just a little bit at the beginning of the war, called 0.10, 0.10, the last futurist painting exhibition. And here were fields of geometric objects that challenged every notion of representing reality conventionally. Nothing could be further from what they like to call Philistine art, the art of order, of clear and normal representations of the world. Nothing could be more radical, more challenging, and for good measure, of course, he wrote a manifesto and tacked it on the wall of the exhibit as well. In all of his work, one sees the same thing, a desire to paint in ways that wouldn't just reflect the world, but challenge people to think in new ways about the world and evoke strong feelings. Now, one can see that iconoclasm is very strong in all this, but it's not just nihilism, not just a rejection of everything in futurism. These were, after all, futurists. They had a vision of where the world was going. Partly, as I've suggested, they were trying to express some deeper truth about the world, which to them was about vital, strong emotions. But it was also about modernity. They embraced this chaos of modern life. Remember, they gazed at the nothingness of tradition from the height of skyscrapers, which Russia didn't have. This was an imaginary skyscraper they stood upon. Similarly, in much of their art, they actually include objects of modernity in their works, pieces of steel, pieces of glass. And they also wrote about and painted about modern objects. They like to portray machines and iron and skyscrapers. To quoute one of these artists, Larionov, who we spoke about before from another manifesto, he said, "We declare the genius of our day to be trousers, jackets, shoes, tramways, buses, airplanes, railways, magnificent ships." And they often featured pictures of these things in their writings and in their paintings. Now, some artists followed this logic to the end, and, as I suggested, not only pictured images of modernity, but included it in their paintings themselves. Now, it might seem, and I think it should seem, that all of this was very optimistic, this futurist movement, that it was hopeful, much more hopeful than decadence seemed to suggest. They were trying to awaken people to a new world, to a coming new age. They were trying to seek some deeper truths, mainly emotional truths, and awaken people to look beyond the conventions of everyday life. And they believed, above all, in this modern world, this world of change and transformation and building and even chaos and construction and challenge to morality. But reality about their optimism is not so simple. A contemporary poet, a symbolist poet, we'll talk more about symbolism later, a man named Alexander Blok, described Russian futurism, which he knew quite well. He knew all of these poets and painters personally. He described it with a very perceptive phrase. He said, "Futurism reflects in its foggy mirror a characteristic joyful horror. There's plenty of evidence to suggest that, in fact, these artists and writers, these futurists, were not without anxieties about the modern world that they so intensely embraced as they were trying to tear down the old world. And one can see this hesitation, in what was probably the most famous futurist publication of the pre-war period, a futurist opera, called, what could be more conventional than an opera, so they had to transform the genre, called Victory Over the Sun. It was performed in a public park in St. Petersburg in 1913, the very eve of the war, and remember, in public, a statement within this public sphere. Kazimir Malevich, the famous painter, designed the scenery and the costumes. Alexei Kruchonik, the famous trans-rational language poet, wrote the script. And the story is about a struggle between the forces of the future and the forces of the past. In many ways, it's the story of Russia's fate at this moment, and for them as well, the world's. The future wins. They are futurists, after all. And it wins by stabbing the sun, like a hooligan, and capturing it. A rather potent image suggests not only the violence of hooliganism, but also the daring of Prometheus, who also, as it were, captured and stole the sun in the name of the future. However, the future world created by these strong men who build the earth by capturing the sun is not a particularly happy one. There are, of course, the strong men, as they're called, who conquer the future. But most people, unlike the strong men, had a hard time adapting to this new created world. Most of them, they say,